At the end of December 2011, Congress ended all government subsidies to corn-based ethanol. But why was there a subsidy in the first place, and who was getting that subsidy? And most importantly, how does it affect the ethanol industry or farmers in western Wisconsin? We'll talk about it this hour. I'm Rich Kramer, and this is The West Side. Western Wisconsin has two ethanol plants. There's Ace Ethanol in Stanley and Western Wisconsin Energy LLC in Boyceville. And there's many, many corn farmers in between. To help us understand how the end of this ethanol subsidy may impact that industry and those farmers, we're glad to have Bob Sather on the program. He is the Director of Government Relations for Ace Ethanol in Stanley. And he joins us by phone. Bob Sather, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
And also on the program, we are joined by Jerry Clark. He is a crops and soils educator through the UW Extension for Chippewa and Eau Claire counties. Jerry, thanks so much for being here as
thanks
well.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
And we are also joined by Bill Kruger. He's a corn farmer from Knapp. And Bill, thank you for taking the time.
And we appreciate you having a program on ethanol, and thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure. And as always, we'd like to hear from you, the listener. What do you think about corn-based ethanol? Is it the answer to our energy needs, and should we be looking elsewhere? Give us a call. The number is 800-228-5615 for you to get in on the program and to have your questions and comments aired for all to hear. Otherwise, you can leave a question or a comment on the West Side Facebook page. Just go to Facebook, look in the search for the West Side. And I'd like to start out with Bob Sather. And I guess a little bit of background real quick before we even get into the ethanol, the subsidy. But real quickly, if you could sum up how the corn gets from the field to the gas tank. And we could maybe have the others jump in here too.
Well, corn is, of course, harvested. It's brought in by truck primarily to the ethanol plant. It's then ground, and then we put it in fermentation and then distillation, and then from distillation we make ethanol. Ethanol, you want to remember, is alcohol, 100%, 200-proof alcohol.
So you guys are making moonshine.
Exactly. It's been one big, huge still.
Okay.
But one thing positive about it, if you spill it, it's biodegradable. Versus gasoline or any petrochemical product, it clearly has deleterious effects to the environment, totally.
All right. Well, as I mentioned in the promo or the beginning of the show, the end of last year marked the end of what's known as the VTEC ethanol subsidy or tax credit. Who did that credit go to, Bob Sather?
That's a good question. I think the public perception out there is so misleading for their understanding what this was all about. First of all, what ended was a 45 cents a gallon tax subsidy. And a lot of people think it went to the ethanol producers, like plants like Ace Ethanol or Western Wisconsin. It did not. Not a penny of that went to any of the plants. The money went to the terminals that blend the ethanol together with gasoline. Now, who owns the terminals? Oil companies own it. Oil companies got the subsidy indirectly through the blending of the ethanol at their terminals. Now, what's a terminal? It's like the one between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls. They're huge, huge storage facilities that blend ethanol with gasoline. So the money went not to the producers, but it went to the terminals that blend the ethanol. So why was the subsidy created to begin with? Ethanol was a emerging type of a product that was going to provide an incentive so that the oil companies would blend it. If we didn't have that incentive, they wouldn't blend it because that would give them competition.
But aren't there mandates that kind of do the same thing?
Then subsequent to that, EPA required a certain amount of ethanol to be blended. So that came after the fact of which we're talking about initially. So, yes, indeed, this year it's mandated advanced biofuels together with ethanol to be about 15 billion gallons blended this year.
All right, and it's expiring because the lawmakers, in their infinite wisdom, figured that the business would be, or the blenders would be able to do this at a profit by now?
Yes, it's becoming a mature type of business versus initially it was not. It was just at the beginning, is the government is often subsidized, for example, beginning businesses so they get off the ground and become successful. Rail, aviation, transportation, we can go on and on, ad infinitum on that. So, but, ironically, guess what? Congress did not eliminate the subsidies to big oil relative to oil depletion allowances, where they receive billions and billions of dollars a year.
Right. It seems that there have been talks about, you know, possibly getting rid of that, but it seems like that's some sort of a sacred cow, and I imagine it might have something to do with campaign contributions.
Well, it's all to do with campaign contributions by big oil. Last quarter, the five top oil companies made $135 billion. Now, do they need a subsidy? Right.
Now, back to the blenders were getting this 45 cents a gallon, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, how did that work out to prices at the pump? I saw some news reports that dated from late December, or before that, the credit, tax credit or subsidy disappeared, and they said, well, gas prices are going to go up maybe 4.5, maybe 5 cents a gallon. Did that happen?
Yes, it did, and about you're right on that. It was about, had an effect of about 5-6 cents a gallon. Remember, they can charge anything they want for the gasoline because it's a global commodity that's sold on the market. The United States exports a great deal of jet fuel, refined gasoline, and so on.
But the pass along definitely impacted the purchasers of gasoline at the pump. Did it cost more for plants like yourself or the Western Wisconsin Energy at all? Did it have any impact whatsoever?
Not really. Not a great deal of impact. Perhaps if we're there, we would probably be getting about another 5 cents a gallon for our ethanol. So, yeah, it did have a slight impact. But it's not going to cripple any plant that's running efficiently and effectively.
And I was speaking with a member of the Corn Promotions Board, and who I believe it was Cal, help me out, Jerry, Cal, never mind. It was a gentleman with this Corn Promotions Board, also had stock or had involvement with a ethanol plant further downstate. And he said that there was a great big rush from the blenders to buy up as much ethanol as they could before this tax buyer, so they could get the tax credit on the gallons that they purchased before the end of the year. Was there a big old rush at Ace Ethanol or plants?
Well, yes,
here?
We exported a great deal, and when you emptied our tanks, that we were storage tanks at that particular time, that's all about money, and then that's what the oil business is all about, of course. They're taking advantage of taking as best advantage they can before the expiration of the tax credit. Now, remember, there's a difference between a tax credit and a tax deduction. But tax credit comes off the bottom line of your tax return.
Okay. Now, we say that there's no more subsidies for ethanol, but isn't there still a subsidy out there for cellulosic ethanol, which
yes,
is...
Right. That's an advanced fuel that you make ethanol from cellulose materials. That will expire in one more year, unless it's extended.
And that's quite a bit more, isn't it?
The amount? It's not very much is being produced at this year, and that's still an emerging type of industry by which we're trying to make cellulose out of, or make ethanol out of products which are not food-grade products, but are products other than food-grade products, which is cellulose. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to make it from that because you're trying to break down a sugar molecule that is very difficult. It's called the C6 sugar molecule, and I won't go into detail unless there are some questions on that.
But one thing that comes to mind, switchgrass. That seems to be a hot topic for ethanol.
Right. Switchgrass is one. We can use wood chips as be another. And we could even use municipal waste. Separate out the recyclables, use municipal waste. There are about three plants demonstrating in the United States now that we can recover ethanol from municipal waste. And you get a tipping fee by doing that, by the way.
Hmm. So does Ace or the Western Wisconsin, do they produce any cellulosic ethanol at this point?
No, not at this time. You could say we do produce some in the sense that we extract oil, which is it just comes from the part of the cellulose part of the process. So corn oil is used for about 1.2 million gallons a year. A plant of 50 million gallons is extracted a year, and this is used either for food grade oil or it can be used for making biodiesel.
Okay. With that, I want to let our listeners know that they can call in with any questions or comments on corn-based ethanol or other types of ethanol that or other types of product that you'd like to see ethanol made of, or whether or not ethanol is the answer. Our number is 800-228-5615. The number again is 800-228-5615. We've got wide open phone lines, and I haven't seen any comments on Facebook yet, but we're waiting for them. Now, so if ACE ethanol isn't producing any cellulosic ethanol or ethanol from things like switchgrass, if this, I believe it's a dollar or so per gallon tax credit, if that expires in 2012, would you care?
Well, sure we care, because those plants would fold. They would never, they couldn't make it financially. They'd get a dollar and a penny a gallon currently, and that will extend for one more year. It'll cripple the industry from my perspective.
The entire industry, I mean...
I'm talking about the entire cellulosic industry.
Okay.
The entire ethanol industry, let's get that straight.
Okay. All right, well, so Bill Kruger, I'll go to you now. As a corn farmer, does this, Bob Sather says the loss of this 45 cents a gallon credit that goes to the blender doesn't impact the ACE ethanol a whole lot, maybe 5 cents or so per gallon. But as a farmer, does that hurt the prices that you get for your corn, for your grain?
Well, no, I haven't seen any loss in profit on corn because of that. We didn't lose something that we didn't have, and that was a benefit of the 45 cents for blending credit. I think I want to respond to something else along the line of subsidies that I think we overlook.
Sure.
And that is when we started to raise money to build our plant in Boyceville, Wheeler area, WWREC.
Of which you were a member of the co-op?
Yes, I was one of 535 farmers that bought stock to raise money to build this ethanol plant. And we started out approximately 10 years ago, and of course we caught resistance on many issues, and one was the subsidy you keep hearing it, and it was, I think Bob answered that one pretty well, with the exception of crude oil sold for $20 a barrel for years and years and years, up to 10 years ago. But people don't realize in a GAO, our government accounting office, which measures how many dollars we spend on tourism and exports and imports, calculated that for every $20 we spent on crude oil, we also spent $20 for defense to protect this crude oil.
Hmm.
And whether that's a subsidy or an expense, call it what you want, but it comes out of the taxpayer's pocket.
Sure. Sure. Along the same line, do you get subsidies for growing corn specifically for the purpose of getting it to Boyceville or to Stanley to make it into ethanol?
That's a little bit of a double-edged question in that farmers are subsidized for growing crops, but it's not for the sole purpose of producing ethanol. That crop can be used for anything. And, of course, those subsidies are drying up, too. And who knows with what the 2012 Farm Bill will bring, we have no idea.
All right. Okay. Well, tell you what, we've got a caller on the line. We will go to them right now, and then we'll take a quick break shortly after. But we've got Tim on the line from Wapaka. I imagine that he's on the road and not calling from Wapaka because I don't think our signal is that strong. But Tim, you're on the air, and what's on your mind?
Well, I would like to ask the question as a consumer about the viability of ethanol. And I ask that based on the fact that in 2009, I purchased a new truck, and I purposely bought it with the flex fuel option engine.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, there was about 80 cents difference between ethanol and gasoline. I think everyone knows that when you burn ethanol, you get about 3 to 4 miles per gallon less than you do with regular gas. So as gasoline has come down, ethanol has not. Probably over the last 8 months, it stayed steady. As gas has come down, now there's only 18 cents a gallon difference. And as a consumer, it doesn't make it viable anymore for me to burn ethanol.
All right, Bob Sather, a response?
Oh, that's a real good question. Of course, the retailers buy the fuel that they're licensed to buy, like Shell Oil, tells them what fuel to buy and what price to set. And so they're really getting a bigger margin, if you will, on ethanol now because they did not bring it down as they brought gasoline down. And so they want to sell their gasoline, and they're not interested in making the margin on profit. They want more of a profit margin on ethanol. In the future, we can look for futuristic engines that will be designed to burn 100-octane gasoline. They will be turbocharged. They will meet the CAFE standards, which means the mileage of 50 miles to gallon. They will also be able to meet the EPA requirements of Tier 3, so they'll meet greenhouse gas emission requirements, less tailpipe emissions. They will have eliminate the benzenes, xylenes, and all those particulate matters which cause pollution. And you get much better gas mileage out of this type of new engines. The big three motor companies are working on those engines now to meet these federal requirements. So that's in the future, and we're working with them to make this happen.
All right. Does that answer your...
But my question, I guess, more pertains to the E85. Is that going to be a viable fuel in the future if the prices stay the same as gasoline or only, a few cents difference between the two? Because, the mechanics tell you that you're better off burning regular gasoline in your vehicle, and of course you do get less miles per gallon with ethanol. So I guess my question is really the viability. Is ethanol going to be around another year from now?
Oh yes, it'll be around. But it's a commodity. We do not set those prices. Major oil companies, who are the wholesalers, set those prices, and that goes to the retailers, and they don't have much to say about it.
Okay.
As a commodity, it will fluctuate. Just like any commodity fluctuates, the price of corn fluctuates. Now, a lot of people, for example, the food versus fuel issue, think that using corn for ethanol has made the price of fuel, food much more costly. But it's paralleled the price of wheat, and wheat is not used for ethanol, and wheat's gone up proportionally to the price of corn. So I rest my case there.
All right. Well, we're going to get into that whole argument a little bit later.
Okay.
But Tim, thanks so much for the call. And anyone else that wants to get in on this discussion about ethanol and federal subsidies and all that, give us a call at 800-228-5615. But now we will take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from Bob Sather, Jerry Clark, and Bill Krueger. This is The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio's 88.3 WHWC, Menominee Eau Claire. We're talking this hour about the end of a federal subsidy to the ethanol industry and about the greater question about the viability and the future of ethanol. I'm joined this hour by Bill Krueger. He's a corn farmer from the village of Knapp. Jerry Clark is an agricultural expert with UW Extension. And on the phone, we've got Bob Sather, a director of government relations for Ace Ethanol in Stanley. If you've got a question or a comment for any of our guests, give us a call at 800-228-5615. We are up against another break here at 5:30, but in the meantime, I want to ask you, Jerry Clark, corn prices were pretty good to farmers last year. And during another West Side program that you and I were on, We talked about the amount of farmland in western Wisconsin dedicated to growing corn, and that's jumped. That's on the rise. Is how much of that is due to the ethanol industry?
I think part of that has been influential for what the ethanol industry has brought, especially to western Wisconsin between those two ethanol plants. I think another factor has been as the dairy farming industry gets a little older, that average age dairyman is getting around that retirement age, a little less younger of a farming population and dairying. A lot of that land has been converted over to a cash grain operation with corn and soybeans. So when the two ethanol plants went in, I think that has helped accelerate that a little bit. We had a market for corn real close by. We didn't have to truck it very far.
Sure.
So what the basis is a marketing measure that we look at between futures and cash prices from the Chicago Board of Trade to a local market. A local cash market, and we saw that basis narrow up quite, 5 cents to a dime, and then of course demand globally has gone up for corn, as China has increased their economy, and changing in their diet, in adding more protein and meat and that type of thing, that has to be fed corn, so we've seen marketing in a global sense increase. So last year with the high demand, not just from ethanol, but demand globally as well. That helped really surge prices because stocks are something, the ending stocks are something we look at through the USDA markets and what their estimates are for how much corn we're going to carry over at the end of the year. And that was at one of the lowest measures that we'd seen in several years. So it was very low in that 2 billion bushel, which isn't a lot, sounds like a lot, but it's not when we look at we can basically use that up in a short amount of time. So we try to have that ending stocks be somewhat elevated to keep prices down if you're looking at it from a food consumer standpoint. But from a farmer standpoint, that basis came up and that demand came up and we saw it prices skyrocket.
I'll hold you right there. We'll talk more about how ethanol may or may impact the price of our grains for our local farmers. This is the West Side. It's time now for Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Rich Kramer, and this is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about how the elimination of a federal tax credit may impact the local ethanol industry and about the greater implications of the industry itself. We're talking with Bob Sather of Ace Ethanol in Stanley, ag expert Jerry Clark of UW Extension in Chippewa and Eau Claire counties, and Bill Kruger, a corn farmer from the village of Knapp. If you have any questions about ethanol, give us a call and become part of the discussion. The number is 800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615, or you can leave a message or a question on the West Side Facebook page. We just spoke with Jerry Clark of UW Extension. He's the crops and soils educator there, and about how the ethanol industry impacts the amount of corn that's grown in the area and perhaps the prices. How much corn from western Wisconsin goes to an Ace Ethanol or the Boyceville plant?
Well, on a national average, it's estimated that 40% of the corn crop goes to ethanol. And just for some figuring I did last year, I took the counties and I took Chippewa County and the counties that surround it, immediately touching it. And took what the Boyceville plant uses and what the Stanley plant uses for corn and just divided that out by the number of acres of corn that were grown in those eight counties, the Chippewa County and the seven that touch it. And that came out to 40%. Now, obviously, that's a crude way of looking at it. But if it's looking at it from a direct impacts type of plant, I think it came out to like 38%. So we were right in that 40% estimate of what the USDA looks at it from a national standpoint. So I think, these plants get their corn obviously from Minnesota and farther away than the seven counties around Chippewa County. But so I think that number is pretty close, that 40% of the corn rows out there do end up being trucked to an ethanol plant.
And Bill Kruger, as a farmer, what does it mean having that plant nearby? I mean, is it a lot easier than bringing it somewhere else? And where else would you bring your corn if it didn't go to Boyceville or Ace or Stanley?
Excellent question, and I've worked out some numbers to answer that very question. I truck 40 miles round trip to my ethanol plant in Boyceville. If I haul it to the cities, to the river, I'd go 140 miles. So I'm saving 100 miles per load. As an example, I have 200 acres of corn, 150 bushel per acre. That's 30,000 bushel. That's 30 loads. I save 3,000 miles. That's a lot of fuel that's not going up into the air. I save $3,000 on trucking. I make $4,500 on patronage refund because it's co-op and I'm a member. Mm. I take that $7,500. I'm talking economics locally now. Rather than having our money flow east as it generally does to Wall Street and different banks, we want to keep it in the area. That's $7,500. You multiply that times the 534 members, you're looking at $4 million that stays in the community. Add to that, we have 40 employees at the Boyceville plant. Ace and others have their employees also. But at roughly $45,000 annual income, we're adding another 1.8 to the local economy, 1.8 million. Hmm. The property that our plant is on used to pay $600 in property taxes. Now, since the plant has been built, we pay $600,000 in property taxes. That goes to Dunn County and the township, which is a heck of a boon. So I think the economics of keeping money and the value added is great. I think Bob will probably talk about corn oil and DDGs and some other things here as we go on, but I want to throw that in because it's very, very important.
Before we get in, go ahead, Bill.
And where I guess, where do you think we might spend our money? Probably at the implement dealer or at the co-op buying more fertilizer or maybe paying health insurance or cars or pickups. It stays local, and it has a magnifying effect, so it's great. It's not just the farmer that benefits, then it's a whole community, the whole economic base in the area.
And I need to pick up on that.
Absolutely, and before we get into byproducts, we do have a caller that's going to ask just about that.
Bill's right on, of course, what he's just saying. We have over 1,000 people that receive either a check, a 1099, or a W-2 statement from Ace Ethanol, plus there's the ancillary carryover of all the things that Bill says the money spends within the community. In the state of Wisconsin, we employ directly and indirectly over 9,000 people in the ethanol business, about 400,000 nationally. A lot of jobs, a lot of people to the rural areas that would be devastated without it.
And with that, we're going to go to the phone lines one more time. We've got Mark in Chippewa, and he's got a question about byproducts. What's on your mind, Mark? And thanks for calling, by the way, to the west side.
Hey, I'd like to know what happens to the grain once it's processed. Where does the byproduct go? And then I have some dormant property in the area that I've had quite a few people come up and ask about renting. What is the going value for renting property for corn ground? And then again, how do you protect that property instead of having it tilled, have corn grown on it X amount of years? How do you protect that property so it isn't run down into the ground?
Well, Bob, let's talk about the byproducts first.
Yeah, let's talk about the byproducts. Then we can talk about probably Jerry, who could have some ideas on protecting the property. There are four primary byproducts are produced in ethanol. A lot of people think we just make ethanol. That's not the case. We produce 400 ton of distiller's grain a day. It's a high protein. It's better than corn for the cattle in a lot of respects because it's higher in protein. 400 tons a day at one plant, and they'll produce more at Western Wisconsin. We produce 300 ton of CO2. Oh, wait, how is it being used? Distiller's grain is fed feed to cattle and for feed.
Yeah.
And we've produced about 300 ton of CO2. That's carbon dioxide. And it's used by meat processors to keep the meat cold. You know, CO2, it can be made into dry ice or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also used for soda pop, Liney Kugel's beer, and so on and so forth. And it's the offtake. We wholesale that. We don't retail any of that stuff. And also we produce corn oil, about over 1 million gallons. and that can be used for food product together with or made into biodiesel. And some plants produce brands, and that's sold as a feed product, a food product for people, human consumption. You've heard of various types of brands when you go and get to the grocery store for the cereal boxes. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have got the misconception we only produce ethanol. In that kernel of corn, we get a lot of things out of it.
And Jerry Clark, about the protecting the property, what is he talking about there?
Well, sure. I think anytime there's a piece of land out there that's, again, with high corn prices, that also brings up land values come up and, again, rental rates.
Sure.
So if landowners have a piece of property that maybe they want to rent out for an extra income, right now competition is pretty good. Farmers are looking for extra land if they want to plant some extra acres of corn. From a protection standpoint, that usually comes in from the landowner's standpoint. What do you want to? How do you want to protect it? So things like that farmer, if he's going to plant corn, will it have to be no-tilled? What type of pesticides are going to be used? Do you want it to be organic? You're going to have to, you know, spell out in that lease what you want to protect. If it's got sloping land, do you want to have contour strips in it, buffer strips? These types of things. Conservation tillage options. So these things are things that the landowner should think about when they want to put into a lease agreement. And then typically most lease agreements can be year to year, but we're seeing them stretched out, you know, 3 to 5 years so a farmer can use that and get the fertility built up. So these types of arrangements between the landowner and the farmer should be spelled out in a written agreement that so it's not just a handshake and that land can be protected. So after 3 or 4 years, if they want that landowner ends that agreement, they can put it back into a conservation program or some type of wildlife area, that type of thing.
So if you've got some extra land that is sitting idle, now is the time to get it into corn?
Well, there's I think farmers are looking for. We just did a recent rental land rent survey in western Wisconsin. So if you're in the western Wisconsin area, contact your local county extension agent. They should have your latest land rent survey that we did, and USDA also has a county average. So it's going to depend from county to county, township to township. Again, it gets back to kind of competition. Two or three farmers want a piece of land. You can maybe sit back and watch let the bidding start. So it all depends on some factors, where that land is, access, and again, fertility. There's a lot of different factors that come into determining that land rent.
All right. There you go, Mark. Any other questions?
No, that's good. Thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks for calling in. And to other callers or potential callers that might want to get in on this conversation, the number is 800-228-5615. That number again is 800-228-5615, or you can post on the Westside Facebook page. I'd like to talk about mandates. Bob Sather, we mentioned there's an energy independence, we mentioned mandates, but 2007, Congress passed the Energy Independence and Security Act.
Correct.
Which says by 2022, 36 billion gallons of ethanol has to be produced, and I imagine has to be mixed in with gas. Just mandates in general, should the government be picking what types of technologies to mandate, or what type that should be the future for clean energy or otherwise?
That's a good question. It was called Renewable Fuels 2. Which was passed what you made mention of. And the reason for that is, without that, you would have a predator, big oil companies. They would have no incentive to blend. They would have a monopoly, and then the price of gasoline, God knows what it would go to. So what it is a checkmate against the predator, big oil companies, and then requiring them to blend or use. It also helps us with energy independence. It gives us the security of home protection against of homegrown type of a motor fuel versus importing it. We have 15 billion gallons of ethanol being produced nationally. That's equal. Now, I say 15 billion gallons, that's kind of an abstract number. Mm-hmm. But if I say it's as much as we import from Saudi Arabia in oil, now that rings home because Saudi Arabia is our third biggest importer of oil. So it's not the answer to all of our fuel problems, ethanol isn't, but it's in the equation to maybe many things that have to happen. And Bill made mention of the fact, gosh, he knows what it costs when you have to protect the sea lanes. But the World Bank said the fossil fuel subsidies internationally is about $350 billion.
Wow. And getting on the same topic, on the mandate topic, just this week it was announced that Wisconsin Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner has introduced a bill that would block a 15% ethanol blend because he says it's harmful to engines. The current blend is around 10%, I believe. The bill that he introduced was approved by a vote of 19-7 in a House committee. How would blocking this bill affect ethanol plants or even local corn farmers, Bob Sather?
Well, it would directly affect them in a very negative way. That bill is not going to go anywhere. As I said before, Sensenbrenner is funded by the Koch brothers, who is big oil, and that's why he's doing that. And these fuels have been tested by EPA for the last 10 years, and it's been tested by the University of Minnesota studies and about five other studies as well. And, if, by the way, what we're asking is they give the consumer choice. This is a choice. They don't have to buy E15. They can buy no blended ethanol if they want. But so this is a smokescreen. That bill is going nowhere. It came out of committee. It will never even get on the floor of the House of Representatives, and the Senate will never take it up. It's a smokescreen.
But in the same article, I read this in the Journal Sentinel, and the same article mentioned a test that the U.S. Department of Energy ran, and this kind of gets back to the effect of ethanol on engines, which was mentioned by one of the callers earlier. And this test supposedly the Department of Energy ran a test where a 200-horse boat motor was run wide open with gas blended with 15% ethanol, and the results showed that it broke down after 300 hours of continuous running. And during the same test, a motor running without blended gasoline had no problems. And the article also went on to mention that a lot of small engine manufacturers say they don't want it. Does this mean that ethanol is unsafe?
They don't know. No. They don't have to have it. They don't have to buy gasoline blended with ethanol, small engine people. They can buy gasoline with no ethanol. It's available at every one of the gas stations.
Okay. Well, but you know, costs more. Does that mean that we're forcing consumers to pay more to keep their small engines running, I guess?
Well, if we didn't have the ethanol there, for the other blends, the price of gasoline would be 80 cents more a gallon than it is now.
Really?
Yeah, because that's a Purdue study. A lot of people aren't aware of that. If you take 15 billion gallons of the motor fuel supply out of the market and you have the same supply and demand, the price of gasoline is going to go up because you'd be 15 billion gallons less. That study indicated, a Purdue study, 89 cents a gallon would be the increase in gasoline without the 15 billion gallons of ethanol out there in the market.
With that, let's take our final break here on the West Side. We've got enough time to take a few more calls later once we get back. The number is 800-228-5615. Our phone lines are wide open right now. That number again is 800-228-5615. What do you think about ethanol? What do you think about the whole food versus fuel argument? Is it a myth? Is it a reality? Does it drive up prices of things like food? But give us a call and let us know what you think. The number, 800-228-5615. We're taking our final break. We'll be right back with more here on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and this is the West Side on WPR. Thanks for listening. We're talking about ethanol and the ethanol industry in western Wisconsin with the two plants, one in Stanley, that is Ace Ethanol, and then Western Wisconsin Energy LLC in Boyceville. Our guests this hour are Bob Sather. He is a director of government relations for Ace Ethanol in Stanley. And we've also got Bill Kruger. He's a corn farmer from the village of Knapp. And we've got Jerry Clark, a crops and soils educator for UW Extension with Chippewa and Eau Claire counties. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, please do feel free to call us at 800-228-5615. That number again is 800-228-5615. And just as I was wrapping up, I got a message, I saw that Bill wanted to get in on the whole food versus fuel argument and whether or not the ethanol is increasing the cost of food. Bob Sather mentioned earlier that there's a whole another set of factors that impact that, and it's not ethanol. Bill, what's your two bits on that?
Okay. Excellent question and excellent concern. The boat that blew up after 300 hours, you find all kinds of opponents and proponents for ethanol. And of course, there's so many variables in that story, and there is in the food, cost of food. Okay. One of the concerns was, and it went around, that the cost of corn was getting so high that people in Mexico couldn't afford to buy corn to make tortillas.
Mm-hmm.
And upon a little bit of introspection and checking, we find out, A, that they use white corn to make tortillas. We raise yellow corn. Probably more importantly, the Mexican government, their federal government, has mandated that only 10% of the corn they use for tortillas can be imported. So we could put every acre we had into corn. They're only going to import 10% of their usage. And that could come from Brazil or Argentina, not us. So when you dig into some of these things, you find out the fallacy. Grocers Association was concerned about the cost of food. They hired Parker and Grove, a PR firm, to go to the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, to talk about how farmers were making so much money that food went up. Well, as you do a little bit of the math, you'll find out that if corn doubled in price, the 8 ounces of corn that's in a box of cornflakes, which cost 8 cents, would go up to 16 cents. Does that justify an 84-cent increase in the box of cereal? Of course not. So you got to decipher some of the reality from what you read on the internet or here. That's my contribution.
Thanks so much for that. We do have a caller on the line in Chippewa Falls. We go again, and this time we've got Orly. Orly, what's on your mind?
I just want to say one thing. Why is it we as society constantly take scientific information from a politician? It's like, wouldn't we go to the people who know, not a politician? And I think, you know, I am for ethanol, 100%. You guys make a great argument for this. I love it. And unfortunately, we get a lot of our information from politicians who are getting paid by big oil companies and other people who want to squash it.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Orly. Go ahead, Bob.
Take relative to food versus fuel. USDA cites that the primary cost, 85% of the cost of going into the higher-priced food products is the transportation. The average thing in a supermarket today comes about 1,200 miles. 1,200 miles. Now, the price of motor fuel for 18-wheelers to bring that stuff there, that's where 85%. Yes, did ethanol have a slight cause for it to increase? Less than 5% of the increased amount. So it's very minuscule compared to other things. So let's put things in perspective.
All right. And we'll take our final call of the evening, and we are getting close to the top of the hour. So we go now to Menominee, and we've got, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Thad is online?
Yes.
Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I had a question on as far as the E85. I mistakenly put E85 in my car, and it's not E85 certified. Are there any plans to make it maybe user-friendly so you don't make that mistake at the pump?
Bob Sather?
Well, it's labeled pretty, you just kind of consumer beware there because it's well labeled. Matter of fact, I use it in my regular car. I mix it about 50-50, and it runs just fine.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's anecdotally. I'm not going to go out there and say everybody should put 50% ethanol, 50% gasoline in their car. And
sure.
It's only certified for E10.
Well, hopefully it works well for you, Thad, and thanks so much for calling. Real quick, you know, Brazil runs almost entirely in their vehicles ethanol, but they make it from sugarcane. Does that mean that their process using that sugarcane is more efficient than making it from corn, Bob Sather?
Well, one thing, you can only make it during the harvest period of sugarcane. It has a short shelf life, so it would degrade and you couldn't use it. So, yes, you can make ethanol out of sugar cane. It's more efficient in the fact you get more of the C5, C6 sugar carbon molecules out of that type of a product than you do out of corn. So, yeah, it's just works fine for them, but it wouldn't work here. We can't raise sugarcane in the United States, probably southern Louisiana, maybe so, and part of maybe Florida, but it's just not a product that we can use here.
That we can't. We don't have the climate whatsoever.
That's
maybe
correct.
Maybe down in Florida, but not here. All right, that's our time. I'd like to thank my guests so much for being part of this program. Bill Krueger, Bob Sather, and Jerry Clark, thanks all for taking the time to discuss the ins and outs of our Western Wisconsin ethanol industry and a pretty complex and interesting topic. I'd also like to thank Team Westside for helping with the program tonight. That's including Mort Cypress for on-air production, Henry Lippold for producing the show, Grace Fair for promotions, and Ellen Zemaripa and Dean Kallenbeck for keeping our ducks in a row. Be sure to tune in next week for the Westside's 10th anniversary show. We'll celebrate with a look into how Western Wisconsin media has changed over the last couple decades. If you missed part of the show or would like to listen again, check out our online archives by going to WPR.org, clicking on the Westside link, and then on the Listen Here link. I'm Rich Kramer. We'll chat again next week.